If in the beginning we have to doubt the ready-made gods and reject them and their legacies of revelation as sources of sure knowledge, this is only to clear the ground for a thorough investigation into what is the irrefutable truth about the whole matter. And if later conclusions may here be hopefully anticipated, we shall happily succeed through philosophy in rediscovering the true God, not in losing him. A famous contemporary scientist, after admirable support of the value of philosophy to science and of the truth of metaphysical idealism, proceeded thereafter to cut himself adrift from both philosophy and science and floated away into mere speculation. He wrote reverently of the divine architect who is responsible for this world. He fell into the easy fallacy of thinking that because the best classes of human beings plan their houses architecturally before building them, therefore God must also plan his universe in the same way. He thus reduced his almighty God to the level of a mere human being. Where is the justification for lowering the stature of deity in this way? The scientist did not see, unfortunately, that all these anthropomorphic speculations were but refined blasphemy. Such a God existed in his personal imagination and could not be proved to the satisfaction of everybody else to exist in fact. The student of philosophy should not make an offering of faith before such an altar, because he above all others seeks truth, that is, he must confine his quest to facts and not to speculative imaginations. These words will not be palatable to sincerely pious persons. But whatever critics may make of such statements, there is always one inconvenient fact from which religionists usually turn their faces. God has endowed us all, in however feeble a degree, with thinking power, with the potential capacity to discriminate and reason for ourselves. Should we not therefore use his gift and not scorn it? However, our concern at this point is less with the existence and nature of God than with the help to be derived by the truth seeker from the revelations of religion in their popular form. The question lies enfolded in a larger one, that of the validity of belief in any authority at all, whether it be religious or otherwise. Here the reader must again be warned not to make the error of confusing different systems of dimension in the world of thought. The same rule should not be used to measure both utility and truth. We are not at the moment concerned with the practical value of authoritarianism. This has its undeniable place and is indeed absolutely indispensable for regulating the affairs of society. We are studying the question from a higher dimension altogether, that of philosophy, the search for ultimate truth, and for the time being the reader must drop the lower dimension of thought completely. Otherwise he will mix the issues and bewilder his mind. And it is now that the essential qualifications which have already been described in a previous chapter will prove their worth. Indeed, without their passport he cannot even pass the very threshold of this dimension. There must be adamant refusal to be overawed by authority. There must be an attitude which keenly probes and dissects every dogma which is set up for consumption. There must be a freedom from the ancient prejudices and irrational predilections implanted by heredity, environment and experience. There must be the courage to resist the emotional pressure generated by conventional social forces, a pressure which carries most people along the stream of untruth, dissimulation and selfish interest. What shall we find when the authority of a book, Bible, man or institution is offered as the sole sanction of the philosophical truth of any statement? We shall find that it is always possible to discover elsewhere another book, Bible, man or institution that may also be offered as the sanction for a directly contrary statement. Whatever can be put forward on one side can always be opposed, whether justifiably or not, on the other. There is hardly a religious, sociological, economic, political, literary, artistic, metaphysical or mystical tenet in the history of ancient, medieval and modern culture which does not have or has not at some time had its contradiction equally existent. There is hardly an assertion which has not been vigorously assailed by opponents who make counter-assertions. He who declares that the Hindu religion promises many lives on earth to man will be met by another who objects, the Christian religion promises only one life on earth to man. He who quotes a passage from Buckle to show that history is but the outworking of man's individual and national effort will be opposed by another who quotes a passage from Bunsen to demonstrate that history is the outworking of God's will in the world. Such a setting up of authorities against each other can go on endlessly and has done so during the past ages. Religions will boldly contradict each other, writers will gravely oppose one thesis to another, two historians will unashamedly find the same event as a proof and as a denial of purpose in the world drama. Whence have all these conflicting tenets and discordant assertions been derived? They have invariably been proffered on some dead or living authority. They cannot all be true, many even cancel each other out. The timid inquirer usually ignores this awkward dot position, but the more courageous one will face it fully, for it indicates that somewhere among the statements there is a logical fallacy. He will then be compelled to confess what the sages have long taught, that the mere say-so of any man, be he as world-revered as Muhammad or as world-reviled as Nero, possesses no value at all to the philosophic student but must be thoroughly inquired into if it be true, no less than the statement of the most obscure and the least esteemed of men. Nor can any authority permanently prevent people from inquiring into dogmas forced on them. Even the ant runs hither and thither examining various substances to inquire if they be edible. Credulity arises out of mental weakness, it is to be overcome by strengthening the mental fiber. If the seeker may not make any individual authority final, that is because such a source has often proved fallible in the past and may again fall into error. Its only use for him is as a possible indicator of truth but never as its arbiter. He has no right to accept beliefs solely because somebody else accepts them or because most people accept them. For if the others hold their beliefs on the same basis, then all may have accepted complete falsehoods as being completely true. Hence philosophy is unable to bend the knee before fallible persons but only before hard facts. It applies this formula to all men without exception, whether they be enthroned and crowned as kings, barefooted and yellow-robed as yogis, mitred and cloaked as cardinals or writers mantled with a fame that makes millions follow their every word. Quotation of 1,000 sentences is quite valueless as philosophical proof, although quite valuable in empirical existence in many cases where the authorities quoted are experts in specialized knowledge. The method of disagreement can be applied to all those who quote some authority as final. If they say as proof that A asserts one thing, that does not settle the matter. It is always possible to take up an opposite position and quote B as asserting something else that disagrees with A's statement. This is enough to show that no man can be taken as a final authority. The student on the philosophic quest must therefore entirely discard blind faith, unquestioning acceptance, easy following of tradition and submission to the tyranny of large numbers, for all these are to be reckoned as fallacies of thinking. Though useful to the majority of men for the practical purposes of everyday living as they are useless to him for the ascertainment of a truth which cannot be belied. This is not to say that all such authorities are always wrong, on the contrary, they are sometimes right, it is to say that they might be wrong, that we have no guarantee ensuring their perpetual infallibility. The very occurrence in man of the desire to know, the need to understand, whether it take the form of belief or not, indicates that ignorance is likewise there. Hence it is better to recognize that he must take to a different path if he would gain knowledge, and this he can do only by beginning with doubt. Unless he introduces the element of courageous questioning into his everyday conceptions, he cannot hope to learn more about their validity. It is not possible to reach the summit of knowing the truth of everything unless we start at the bottom with the first step of doubting the truth of everything. This is the only way in which to obtain a guarantee that every further step taken will be a safe one and that we shall not afterwards have to retrace our path in disappointment. It is important to realize that the term doubt is used here in no skeptical sense but in an agnostic one. It is not a correct attitude to deny intolerantly what we do not even understand. But it is perfectly correct to observe, T do not know, I have not seen. Therefore I cannot start with any dogmatic assumptions, whether they be in affirmation or in denial. Such a position WJLL not be taken up by those who are naturally impatient, who are ready to believe anything at once because it pleases them, who are not willing to suspend premature judgment and to pose pertinent questions before advancing forward into acceptance of any claim. Those who jump to the first and easiest conclusion free themselves from the trouble of internal conflict, but they unconsciously commit the fallacy of primitivity. In the end, therefore, their defective attitude must one day yield its fruit in disappointment. An unhurried spirit is therefore an advantage here. This is not to say that we are to rest satisfied with our doubts and be content with the gloomy confinement of agnosticism. It means that we shall make our doubt act as a constantly pressing spur to deeper investigation, and not as a cold clammy hand to dishearten us. The sages say that doubts are extremely valuable provided we are induced to overcome and solve them by persevering search, which carries us eventually to a higher level of understanding. They are not to be forcibly expelled or feebly smothered. And if we foolishly let doubts paralyze all further search, then we have no right to dogmatize pessimistically about the unattainability of truth in general, as so many in the West do. The hidden philosophy says, in a manner contrary to authority, welcome doubt fearlessly as being the first step to certainty. Doubt and you will be saved. But it says this only to the seeker after the highest truth. To all others, to all those who have no time to take thought for such a long quest or no will and no capacity for it either, it unhesitatingly endorses the injunctions of authority. It is well aware of the practical value to such men of ready-made institutions, which, through sacred books and appointed priests, enthroned rulers and office-holding leaders, shall dictate their customary forms of thought, their regular habits of conduct and their basic outlook. It will now be clearer why, when describing the qualifications needed by the philosophic inquirer, great emphasis was laid upon the elimination of the ingrained human tendency to view things from an egoistic platform. For we may now observe that the authoritarians of every kind are so imbued with the colors of their personal predilections and emotional presuppositions that they unconsciously set limits to their possibilities of getting at the truth of things. The hidden route of their assertions is the ego. I am right, says one. No, I am right, retorts another. The I lurks beneath the gregarious ignorance, the fatuous mistakes and the primitive misunderstandings of men. Of all the false beliefs and deceptive illusions which darken the mind, the strongest is that whatever one knows, believes, sees or mentally holds is necessarily true. I know, is the statement which any fool can make, as the sages say. But whether what he knows is correct, he seldom stops to inquire. This is why doubt is needed. It is a characteristic of such people, and it should be remembered that this means almost the whole of mankind, to believe that they plainly understand when they really do not. Hence the sage who is initiating the candidate undertakes as his first task the unveiling of this universal defect. He explains that I know is the conscious or unconscious presumption of mankind, and that humility in its truest sense must be sought and found by the aspirant before he can take a single step forward. And this sense is not only moral but psychological. I know usually means I feel or I experience or I prefer, none of which is a fit criterion of truth. Hence the need of rigorously doubting what we think we know, of sternly putting aside our imaginations, of verifying the ideas and testing the concepts we hold so fervently, and of raising questions in points where we are confessedly ignorant. We should not believe in belief, for belief steps in where reason fears to tread. From intuition to logic, the student must put on his shoes and depart from the hall of authoritarianism. He has tried faith, but it has failed him. Whither shall he go? The first reaction from depending on others is to depend on oneself. Thus arises reference to personal feelings underived from reference to external experience, as a better guide than authority, that is to intuition. So he passes upwards to the second degree of human intelligence, where the knowledge which is offered him seems superior to blind faith. Those who are weary of the contradictions of credulously depending on others sometimes turn away to these personal sources and find therein a fresh certainty, as it appears, and a satisfaction that seems to set them free from such doubtful dependence. We have examples of this in Immanuel Kant, with his interior categorical imperative in the matter of morals, in George Fox and his Quakers, humbly waiting in the silence for words from God, And lastly, in our own times, in Dr. Frank Buchman, whose Oxford groups listen in during the quiet time for intuitive messages of guidance concerning their personal activities in the world. An intuition is a thought or idea which springs up spontaneously and unsought, to be asserted to by the ego without demur. It arises in a flash of its own accord, remains independently of our volition, and departs without even asking permission. It may profess to tell us at a moment's glance something of the real nature of a thing, or it may be prediction of future happenings, or it may be description of events which happened in remote antiquity, or it may, as is most common, proffer immediate guidance for a course of action when faced by a certain set of circumstances. Is it possible to fix here a source that will yield by itself sure knowledge about the object of existence and the meaning of the universe? Alas! A little historical inquiry will soon yield the disconcerting information that the intuitionists of all ages have differed from one another in their final conclusions, have had absurdly contradictory spontaneous guidance, and have ventured into bold statements that time has mockingly falsified. Not all their predictions have failed of fulfillment, nor all their intuitions been in vain. There have indeed been striking instances where words have amply justified themselves and have been verified as correct. The discovery of outstanding technological inventions and useful scientific laws has sometimes come to birth intuitively and of its own accord during moments of relaxation or reverie. But these instances have been so relatively few in number that nobody could in advance guarantee the infallibility of any such statement. On the other hand, the instances of disagreement, unfulfillment, emotional bias, and obvious departure from known facts have been so numerous that we must regretfully confess that the ground upon which the intuitionist walks is unsure and unsafe. If his inner guide has served him unerringly sometimes, there is no guarantee that it will continue to do so. If it remains faultless, he will be unique among men, for experience shows that intuition does not hesitate to mislead the same man whom it has earlier led aright. The best that can be said of an intuition is that it may or may not be true. Most of us find in everyday life that intuitive thoughts strike us from time to time and often prove incorrect, even though they have sometimes been correct. In any case, intuition is not forthcoming at will and therefore is not to be unfailingly relied on. Moreover, those who have not undergone the philosophic discipline are easily a prey to mistake sudden impulse or overpowering emotion for intuition. Once again, the student must take his regretful leave. He may ascend to a higher level and knock at another door, that of logic. Everybody uses it to some extent. The bird, the beaver, and the fish are guided by a natural instinct, but man must find his way by using some thinking power. Logic possesses immense worth in the realms of day-to-day living. It can arrange our thinking in coherent and orderly fashion. It can detect gross errors and various fallacies in our journey from premise to conclusion. It can usefully show us how not to think. But we must humbly confess that the theoretical knowledge of logical rules has never prevented men from making numerous and absurd mistakes. Lawyers use logic in presenting their case to a court. But as their conscious or unconscious purpose is to win the case, it is not infrequent that truth is mauled in the process by every overweighting of lesser issues, by every suppression of awkward or inconvenient facts, and by every appeal to the emotional bias of a jury. Moreover, when we examine the stock syllogism of logic from a philosophical viewpoint, we find it to be quite fallacious. All men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Therefore Socrates is mortal. Beneath the plausible syllables of this classic syllogism hides the gigantic assumption that we have known all men who ever lived in the past, all men who are living today, and all those who shall live in the future. This is entirely impossible. Therefore the syllogism starts with asserted knowledge which, in fact, is no knowledge at all. Logically it is perfect, but philosophically it is defective. It will suffice for the limited conditions of practical everyday purposes, but for the higher purpose of final truth it is completely unacceptable. Expert logicians themselves admit now that it cannot yield new truth but only draw out what is already contained in the given facts. Logic is an imperfect instrument and as such cannot yield absolute certainty. It operates within a limited range of usefulness and validity. and therefore it cannot reveal the ultimate meaning of existence. The walls which surround it are too steep. It occasionally happens that those who become aware of these incurable defects of logic take a shortcut to intellectual relief by turning backwards in their despair or darkness and descending to the vacated level of intuitional feeling, a course which appears to be the only one open to them. Here the intellect may voluntarily abdicate and find repose for a while, but severe disappointments and blatant contradictions are likely to occur sooner or later, thus indicating that no real relief can be got in this easy manner. Others who are unwilling to retrace their steps have begun to desert the old formal methods and to construct non-Aristotelian systems of logic. But these are still in the stage of experiment. The seeker who wishes to leave logic for a higher method will ultimately proceed to the next step, which is that of mystical experience. This is illustrated historically by Ralph Waldo Emerson, with his symbolical influx of the divine mind into our mind, by Jacob Ohm with his sudden illuminations gained from the three trances that marked his life, and by Emanuel Swedenborg with his strange visions of the spirits of dead men and women amidst their heavenly or purgatorial habitats. A mystic experience is sometimes spontaneous but usually self-induced. In the latter case it arises out of the practice of mental concentration or intense emotional aspiration or attention inwardly turned, self-absorbed and prolonged into a condition of reverie or even trance. During these states visions of men, events or places may appear before the mind's eye with extraordinary vividness, voices may be audible to the mystic although to none else, and these may convey to him either a message, a warning, a series of instructions or a religious revelation. God himself may even be felt as an environing and exalting presence. The mystic may fancy himself being wafted into space, as sometimes happens in dream to the non-mystical also, so that he is able mentally to visit distant scenes, persons and spheres. Or he may reach the final consummation in joyous ecstasy which may be violent and erotic or serene and settled, but which he will take as the sign of entry into a higher realm of being, which he usually calls spiritual, the soul, divine reality and so on. Mysticism under the microscope. We have now to consider such experiences from a higher standpoint. First, applying a tenable criterion, let us see how far are the mystics from contradicting each other. Without making a long excursus into a debatable land, it may briefly be said that it must not be thought that mysticism is so unique an experience that all mystics thereafter find themselves in harmony. Far from it. Just as we find that men of religion, from the crudest peasant to the most cultured preacher, vary greatly in personal caliber and mental outlook, so shall we find that similar individual differences exist among mystics. And that once we put aside their five common tenets mentioned in an earlier chapter, even the mystics betray by word and deed that they have achieved not much more unanimity themselves. Although there are several similarities in their doctrines and practices, there are also many unbridgeable differences. Whereas most spend much time ploughing up problematic esoteric meanings buried in scriptures, a few disdain scriptures and regard this practice as imaginative acrobatics and not as spiritual discovery, holding that the time would be better spent in meditating on themselves. Whereas most still cling more or less loosely to the name of some sacred personage like Jesus or Krishna, a few declare that it does not matter much whom one follows provided the presence of divinity is felt. The doctrines about which they disagree are replete with prolific fancies and are much more numerous than the five specified essentials about which they are all likely to agree. Those who dispute this fact, and they are mainly well-meaning but uncritical people, should endeavor to imagine a solemn conclave of the following famous historic mystics imprisoned in a room until they could emerge, declaring their complete unity of outlook. Would they ever emerge at all? Cornelius Agrippa, who mingled mystical piety with strange magic, Emanuel Swedenborg, who chatted familiarly with angels and spirits, Simon Stylites, who sat in lonely self-mortification for many years on the top of a stone pillar, Anna Kingsford, who openly claimed she had killed vivisectors by thought power in order to save the lives of animals, Miguel Molinos, who brought Spanish emotional intensity into his union with God, Eliphaz Levi, who applied queer Kabbalistic interpretations to Catholic theology, Jacob Ohm, who was ecstasy-wrapped amid the old shoes of his cobbler's shop, Kuiko, who taught his mysticism to the Chinese peasants and was cruelly martyred for his pains, and Wang Yangming, who discovered a divine world in his own heart. For this is the hidden limitation and undetected weakness of mysticism, that it is not a quest of conclusive truth so much as a yearning for emotional experience. Therefore the mystic is more concerned to get his feelings temporarily held by a great peace or temporarily thrilled by a great vision or temporarily flattered by a personal oracular message. Hence philosophy accosts or startles him with the question, how do you know that the source of your communion really is God or reality or Jesus or Krishna? But he will listen to no criticism, however impressive it be, of the possible irrelevancy of his conclusions. He will insist on making the undeniable fact of his own experience the deniable criterion of its validity. It is quite inevitable and perfectly human that under such circumstances he should be so irresistibly carried away by the feeling of extraordinary immediacy in the event and by the strength of his uncommon exaltations that he lays stress upon the less essential and that it suffices to satisfy him without his making any further inquiry into its hidden nature and truth. The value of meditation for inner peace, sublime ecstasy and world-free self-absorption is immense. But its value for the quest of truth and reality unaided by philosophy is quite a different matter and demands searching investigation by sympathetic yet impartially critical minds possessed of a sense of proportion and philosophic acumen, qualities usually absent from the mystic's makeup. Ecstasy is indeed a form of personal satisfaction, but it is not either a complete criterion of reality or an adequate evidence of truth. For satisfaction of any kind whatever, however noble it be, is no evidence of truth. Indeed, the warmer a man's feelings and the more propulsive his enthusiasm, the more he should cool and calm them in order to examine experience impartially and impersonally. If it be true, it will lose nothing by such examination, but if it be false, his calmness will greatly help him to detect its falsity. Furthermore, we are faced with the insuperable difficulty that it is impossible to verify the inner experience of another man because ordinarily it is impossible to enter directly into his mind. Even thought transference and thought reading, although genuine possibilities, are still uncommon and still imperfect. We may draw inferences, creatively imagine or make conjectures, but this is not at all the same as actually and perfectly participating in the knowledge or inner experience of another man. The latter must needs be beyond normal human range. So even if a mystic tells us that he has seen God, we have no undeniable means of either confirming or refuting his vision. It is not transmissible. Even if we succeed in reproducing it mentally, it will then be our own production and we can never place both visions side by side and compare their likeness. And granting the occasional accuracy of particular knowledge gained in meditation, it is unfortunately not possible for most other men in other parts of the world to be sure of duplicating the same discovery in the same manner for themselves. They must either resort to mere faith or forego this method entirely. Hence mystical experience is utterly individual and possesses only a personal certainty. Thus the lack of universal certitude which was found among men of faith is now found among men of vision. Where is the guarantee that what they now feel to be the highest state, what they now take to be the loftiest consciousness, the final reality, will not later be replaced by a different one? Goethe correctly pointed out that mysticism was the scholastic of the heart and the dialectic of the feelings. The whole level with which it deals is that of unchecked feeling. But how does the mystic or yogi know that what he has come in contact with during meditation or ecstasy is the ultimate reality? He felt it, therefore it must be real, is the general attitude of most mystics who never pause to inquire. They assume the reality of their feelings because they are so much attached to them as to be blind to the important difference between the seeming existence of a thing and its proven reality, or between what appears to be and what is. How do they know that they have reached the highest state of knowledge? Why should extraordinary peace constitute a sufficient title to the estate of truth? Why should it become a synonym for omniscience? We are quite justified in posing such crucial questions, For in doing so we render a double service, to ourselves and to truth. The votaries of meditation who have found the final truth within its quietude should pause to inquire if it be truth, even if that pause takes a few months or a whole lifetime.